So this is the official cover transparency. You will recognize the hands of NASA graphic artists. LISA is the laser interferometer space antenna, which in the current design has six laser systems on three satellites. You can see that it's not orbiting the Earth, but it's orbiting the Sun in an orbit of 1 AU separation, the same distance between the Earth and the Sun. So it's on the same orbit as the Earth, but following the Earth, about 30 degrees behind the Earth, gradually drifting behind it. And the arm length here is 6 million kilometers. Not 4 kilometers like LIGO, but 6 million. So here is the theoretical astrophysicist, graphic artist version. So this title gets some criticism. Some of you may know that LIGO, the other gravity wave experiment under construction, was not universally beloved by astronomers. And my job today is to try to explain to you why a lot of astronomers actually seem to like LISA, and some of them maybe are even learning to live with LIGO as it gets closer to construction. The reason I'm up here is I'm chair of the U.S. Mission Definition Team for LISA. The Mission Definition Team is a group of cheerleaders and people who actually understand how the instrument might work. And chair of the Mission Definition Team means I'm the head cheerleader. So here is a list of everybody. It's a joint U.S.-European mission. There's the European side over here and the U.S. side on the left. I'd like particularly to draw your attention to Bill Faulkner, who's the project manager on the U.S. side. Pete Bender and Tuck Stebbins, who've been with LISA for about 20 years since they first conceived it. And on the European side, Carsten Donsman and Bernie Schutz, sort of the lead physicist and relativist on the European side. So let me begin with a story in a galaxy far, far away. The Bell 1400 X-ray cluster. At the center of that cluster of galaxies, there's an elliptical galaxy which has twisted isotopes, and in this contour image of a red CCD frame, you can see that the galaxy has two nuclei separated by about 5 kiloparsecs. That's 15,000 light years for any physicist in the audience. And this object is not particularly unique, and what is interesting is if you take a radio image of the same galaxy, you see that it has four jets, I count each side, one pair coming out of each nucleus of the galaxy, and we believe that means that each of those nuclei and these two nuclei has a supermassive black hole of a mass 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9 solar masses, and in about a billion years, these two nuclei will have merged under dynamical friction, and those two black holes will merge, probably, and something interesting might happen when these two of order 10 to the 8 solar mass black holes merge. As I said, this object is not unique. There's several other objects like this known. Now, when those two black holes spiral together, they will emit somewhere between 6 and 50% of mc squared, depending on their spin. So that's 2 by 10 to the 61 ergs times the mass in units of 10 to the 8 solar masses. And that energy will be emitted in a few times gm over c cubed, so about an hour. And the luminosity is c to the fifth over g, which is 4 by 10 to the 59 ergs per second. If this happened at a redshift of 1 in the distant universe, the flux of energy at the Earth associated with this is substantially larger than the flux of energy from the full moon. If you stand out outdoors and stick your hand out, and this were going on, you would have an enormous energy flux. So first of all, you've probably seen gamma ray bursts in the news a lot. Those are 10 to the 53 ergs a second for a few seconds. Completely pathetic things. The only difficulty, of course, is that gamma ray detectors have quantum efficiencies of order unity, and unfortunately, gravitational wave detectors do not have quantum efficiencies of order unity. So the flux of energy is great, but there is a little difficulty in detecting it. So, no, the events are not a problem, actually. Not for LISA, for LIGO. So just to remind you, probably unnecessary in this audience, gravitational radiation is ripples in the fabric of space-time, and when such a ripple passes by, if we have two freely falling test masses separated by a distance L, then as long as L is less than about half the wavelength, What happens to the two bodies is that the metric separation between them changes by a fractional amount, delta L over L, which is h over 2, where h is the measure of the amplitude of this wave describing the ripple in spacetime. And it's a dimensionless amplitude, as you can see, it's delta L over L. And those waves come in two polarizations, just like electromagnetic radiation, except that it's spin 2 rather than spin 1. And so the waves, for example, one sign of circular polarization would take a bunch of test masses in a circle and squeeze them alternately like this, and the other polarization would do the same thing at a 45-degree angle. Now, we can estimate the amplitude from, for example, that merger of the two black holes that I mentioned. That final merger would produce a dimensionless amplitude, which is the ratio of essentially the Schwarzschild radius to the distance to the source. So gm over c squared is half the Schwarzschild radius, and r is just the distance to the source. And if you put in numbers, you can see that this dimensionless amplitude for, let's say, a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, a gigaparsec away at a substantial redshift, is 5 10 to the minus 17. So there's small amplitude waves. We're not talking large separations here. One important thing you'll notice is that if you have an experiment which can measure a given delta L, independent of the separation L, you maximize delta L when the size, the distance between the two test masses is of order half the wavelength, and the wavelength will, of course, be of order gm over c squared from these merging black holes. And so the separation from a detector which is capable of detecting waves of this wavelength goes like the square of the gravity of the mass, or the square of the wavelength. So delta L goes like the wavelength to which the detector is sensitive squared divided by the distance to the source. So LIGO is 4 kilometers, but you bounce the light back and forth a lot of times, so effectively it's integrating over a 3,000-kilometer path length. LISA is sensitive to wavelengths of order 10 to the 7 kilometers, so the separations which the spacecraft has to measure are 10 to the 7 times larger than those of LIGO. Okay, so you know LIGO is a very difficult experiment because you have to get down to quantum limited measurement, et cetera, to have hopes of detecting substantial numbers of sources. This is 10 to the 7 times easier, in some sense, just because you're looking at lower frequencies. And of course, what I'll spend much of the rest of the talk discussing is what kind of science actually looks at these lower frequencies. How is it interesting to look at? So there's one half of LIGO in Hanford, Washington, all completed, vacuum pumped down, doesn't leak, lasers going in. Here's LISA, exists mostly in this form now. Just to remind you of the orbits, each of the three arms is 5 million kilometers orbiting the sun, trailing behind the Earth. And one other point that will be important that we'll discuss later is that the plane containing the three spacecraft is not in the ecliptic plane, it's not in the plane of the Earth's orbit, but it's tilted to 60 degrees relative to it. And this plane rotates around, so once a year the whole plane rotates. There's no fuel being expended in doing this. That's three Keplerian orbits, each of which is tilted by a little bit out of the ecliptic plane, with the line of nodes rotated by 120 degrees, and Kepler's laws keep that configuration with equal arms, except for small perturbations in the solar system, quite equal arms precessing once a year. Okay, just to compare again the detection schemes in LISA and LIGO, they both use lasers, but the actual detection physics is really rather different. You might think of them both as laser interferometers, and LIGO really is a laser interferometer. You have test masses, which on Earth, unfortunately, freely falling test masses don't last very long, so you actually suspend them on wires, and you look at frequencies that are high compared to the pendulum frequency of the wire so that it actually acts effectively as a free mass. And, of course, the ground is bouncing up and down, shaking the test masses all the time, so you have great stacks of rubber and springs, which occupy about the volume of this room to hold up your little test mass to try to isolate it from the ground. And to get good sensitivity, you have about a megawatt of laser power circulating in here, and you hope that it doesn't heat up the mirrors and thermally distort them or crack them or affect the coatings in some way that would interfere with the measurements. And the vacuum is very expensive. There was a lot of civil engineering making 1 meter vacuum pipe by 4 kilometers. The great advantage to LIGO, I have to say, although all those things sound bad, is LIGO is on the ground. If something breaks, you fix it. LISA is easier in many respects, but if something breaks, tough luck. Same thing that happened to the Mars lander, right?
Mars orbiter.
Orbiter, sorry. Well, it was Mars. That was a Freudian slip, maybe. Yeah, the orbital that became a lander by mistake. Yeah. Okay, so LISA truly is freely falling test masses. The masses which are used to reference the separation are freely falling to the precision that one can attain. They're not actually even attached to the satellite. They're freely floating inside the satellite, and the satellite is forced to follow them around. The satellite has lots of radiation pressure forces from the sun acting on it, but the test mass is isolated, and so you sense where the test mass is and make the satellite follow the geodesic against its will by applying forces to the satellite, but you hope that there are no forces applied to the spacecraft, at least in the frequency bands you're interested in. In LIGO, the laser light bounces back and forth many times. In LISA, there are little telescopes which are sending the laser beam out from one spacecraft to the other one, and the telescopes are little Celestron telescopes about yay big, 30 centimeters. And over 5 million kilometers, you can calculate that the diffraction-limited beam is 20 kilometers across when it gets to the other spacecraft, which is another 30-centimeter telescope. So not very much of the light that's emitted by one is received by the other one. So you're not bouncing the light back and forth many times. You're basically just doing spacecraft tracking using a laser. You're just detecting a tiny fraction of the photons of the other one and using it to measure the separation and a modulation also to do a frequency lock. You can work out the laser powers are about a watt here in the proposed design. So you receive at the other telescope about 10 to the 10 photons per second. So you can work out if everything else were great, you'd be limited by shot noise. In over 100 seconds, you could measure the separation to 10 to the minus 6 of a fringe, 1 over square root of the 10 to the 12 photons you received. So that's like 10 to the minus 10 centimeters for micron wavelength. So the RMS shot noise limited H you could reach would be like 2 by 10 to the minus 22 in 100 seconds, or if you had a periodic source that lasted for a year, you'd get down to 3 by 10 to the minus 25. So I'll just remind you of the source amplitude from the merging million solar mass black hole is 5 10 to the minus 17. Here's the RMS, 10 to the minus 22 in 100 seconds. So the final burst you could see, you measure with signal to noise of 10 to the 4. Yeah, I'll discuss what the arms are good for in a minute. Okay, so that's one contrast with LIGO, is that the sources that people have thought of for LIGO, it's going to be a struggle to detect them. You'll measure things that signal the noise of 10, and the noise, they're short-lived sources, as we'll see, and so you have to really work to pull them out. Here, if they're merging black holes in the universe, they'll be whopping signals, and you'll be able to see it in real time with enormous signal to noise. In fact, you have a little bit of the other problem that you have an abundance of riches. So just to compare in frequency, and this is log of the sensitivity at 11 sigma. So this is 11 sigma detections that are plotted here. The LIGO as it will come online in a year or year and a half, and LIGO as further expenditures of $50 or $100 million in advanced detector schemes might allow in the first decade of the 2000s. Just point out, here is the quantum limit for a 30 kilogram test mass. This is when you have to start doing quantum non-demolition schemes, is somewhere between the moderately advanced and the very advanced versions of LIGO. Here's LISA, as I described it. This side of the curve is shot noise. As you go to higher frequencies, you have fewer photons you've measured in that shorter time, and so the noise goes up at high frequencies. At low frequencies, I like to describe this by saying that one of the main functions of the spacecraft for LISA is to provide thermal isolation. The sun's luminosity changes on 5-minute time scales, the same as 5-minute oscillations of the sun, and those varying temperature, of course, if it were directly transmitted to the housing of the test mass, it would mean one side of the test mass would be a little bit hotter than the other side, so there'd be a little bit more sigma T to the fourth on one side than the other. A radiation pressure then pushes the test mass around, and that's uncontrollable, that's the noise. There are also all kinds of, you know, the spacecraft power supply output is not perfectly steady, et cetera. So there are all kinds of thermal variations. Other things you worry about are fluctuations, and the thermal fluctuations will expand and contract the laser system and change the frequency lock a little bit, so you can't stabilize a laser at low frequencies. And so there's basically noise at low frequencies from thermal and other things that you can't control, mainly thermal effects. And the optimal sensitivity is around 10 to the minus 3 hertz periods of 1,000 seconds. Just for comparison, the quantum limit for a 1 kilogram Lisa test mass is down here. Okay, this is all classical spacecraft tracking, nothing sophisticated. And one thing that people sometimes forget, but actually is sort of interesting, because if you think about how the, remember that the source amplitude, if here you're looking at one solar mass object and here a million solar mass objects, the amplitudes of sources at the same distance are a million times larger in this frequency band than in this one, but the sensitivities are actually comparable. So signal to noise one here is signal to noise of many orders of magnitude larger over here. If there were really big black holes, or even not so big ones, but with the orbital separations, there's a hope that pulsar timing can actually detect things with periods of order a year or so. And that was a hot topic when I was a beginning graduate student, and sort of nothing much came of it. But there are now a lot more millisecond pulsars being discovered in big surveys, and a few more clean ones, and I think this actually has the potential for being an interesting measurement technique at very low frequencies. Okay, now, what kind of sources can you see? Here's everything in the universe on one plot. Masses from 0.1 solar mass to 10 to the 10 solar masses. And the separation, and you can think of this as either, if I'm talking about a vibrating body, the size of the body, two halves of it, or if it's like a binary system, two black holes or two neutron stars orbiting each other, think of this as the log of the separation of them in centimeters. And on here I've drawn the sizes of some real objects, like white dwarfs exist for masses between 0.1 and 1.4 solar masses, and they have size as a function of mass indicated here. So if I want to make a binary out of a white dwarf, it has to be bigger than this. If I try to make a smaller binary, that's the merged white dwarf. They don't fit. So binary white dwarfs lie up here. Binary neutron stars lie up here. Binary stars, where the stars are like the sun, burning hydrogen or helium in their centers, lie up here. They're much bigger than white dwarfs and neutron stars. And black holes lie along this line. Now, on this graph, I've also written the merger time. Time to merger, if I have a binary with this separation and two elements of this mass. And here's 1 minute, 1 year, and 10 to the 9 years. And let's now put the LISA frequency bands. If I have a mass and a separation, I have a characteristic orbital frequency, or F-mode frequency for a vibration. Then here's the frequency of LIGO, the range of LIGO sensitivities between about 1,000 hertz and 10 hertz. Here's LISA from 1 hertz to 10 to the minus 4 hertz. And the pulsar timing up here. And you'll see, first of all, that LIGO can never detect white dwarf binaries, because all white dwarf binaries have frequencies lower than LIGO has any hope of detecting, because the Earth wiggles up and down on 1 second periods, and you can't shield that with any amount of rubber. LISA can see white dwarf binaries, and LISA can see white dwarf binaries anywhere up here that have merger times of 10 to the 9 years. So it can see generic binary stars that have been around essentially since the beginning of the galaxy. You'll notice that LIGO, by contrast, anything that it can see, it can't see white dwarfs, but it can see neutron stars or black holes of masses like 10 or 30 solar masses. But the merger time of 1 minute is this brown line. So essentially anything that LIGO sees, it will only have entered the LIGO frequency range when it has less than a minute to go before it finally merges. So LIGO is going to see very short, bursty sources that last for less than a minute, and they'll primarily be neutron stars or stellar mass black holes. So that's what LIGO will look at. LISA will see ordinary binaries with white dwarfs, binaries with neutron stars, binaries with stellar mass black holes, and binaries with million or 10 to the 7 stellar mass black holes. And it can see the white dwarfs in our galaxy with lifetimes of 10 to the 9 years, or neutron stars in our galaxy with lifetimes of 10 to the 9 years. And it can also see million solar mass black holes. Here's time 1 year till merger. It can see the last year of the merger of a million solar mass black hole in its frequency band. And as we'll see, it can see them out to a redshift of 100. No problem with signal to noise. Okay, so just to summarize that, some people sort of think, oh, LISA must be launching LIGO into space. Just to remind you, it's not. The frequency bands are very different. LISA is running 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2 hertz. LIGO is 10 to 100 hertz. In one case, you're seeing the last minutes of mergers of neutron stars and black holes, stellar mass black holes. LISA is seeing binary stars in our galaxy of all kinds, and massive black holes and galactic nuclei. In LIGO, one's looking for sources which last about a minute, and event rates which are once a decade to once a month or so, depending on the sensitivity and uncertainties in the astrophysics, and the signal to noise will be a few. Here there will be 3,000 sources in the sky on all the time, all the white dwarf binaries in our galaxy of suitable periods, and you'll see them as signal to noise of hundreds to 10 to the 4. Here is a real storing and recycling interferometer, and you have to measure the separation of the test masses to precisions like 10 to the minus 19 meters in the initial LIGO and 10 to the minus 21 in the advanced LIGO. Here you have to measure things to 10 to the minus 12 centimeters. So just to remind you, there's the spacecraft configuration. Here are some interior drawings of the guts of each one of those spacecraft. The spacecraft are about this big, 2 meters. Inside there's a little 30 centimeter telescope, and this is the little platinum gold test mass, 4 centimeters on a side, which is the heart which the laser beam is reflected off, goes to the other spacecraft, and you measure the separation between the plane surface on one of this test mass and the remote test mass. And there are 6 of these test masses. Each one of them is a pair, an independent pair. In the back here, I guess in the next diagram, there's an optical bench with a stabilized laser, frequency stabilized laser, and there's a fiber optic that goes to the other one. There are 2 of them on a single spacecraft in this configuration. And the test mass, around the test mass are little capacitive sensors, and you apply a voltage, and when you detect if the test mass moves, you get a voltage signal on the capacitive plates, and you then apply that, use that signal to power thrusters, which prevents the spacecraft from actually banging into the test mass. So you keep the spacecraft following this little test mass in the center. Yeah? Yes, yes. That okay, so you have a number of degrees of freedom. What you actually do in this case is you have 4 degrees of freedom you have to control here, and you have 3 in this. You can move the spacecraft in only 3. So what you actually do is you actually use the capacitive plates to apply forces to one of the test masses, and you record the forces you're applying. So in this configuration, you actually do have to do that. There's another design which is more expensive and was the original European design, which had to make the spacecraft more than a minimum level in order to get funded, right? So you had to gold plate it, essentially, where you had 6 independent spacecraft, so each one of these is independent. In that case, you don't have to do it, but here you do. So the primary issues of technology is you need good laser stabilization at low frequencies. So you're interested in frequency sort of time scales here of tens of seconds to hours. You need the inertial sensor, and you want the noise on it to be less than 10 to the minus 15 Earth Gs. That means that in order to demonstrate, inertial sensors have flown, for example, on the Triad satellite and satellites used to measure the Earth's gravitational potential, which have noise about five orders of magnitude worse than this that are known to measure it. That basically in low Earth orbit or on the Earth, you can't demonstrate the performance of something like this because the environment is so noisy that you can't demonstrate that it works. So one of the... the inertial sensor is. Here's the little test mat. It's the test mass and the little capacitive plates around it. And basically, the issues are, for example, one thing that happens is the cosmic rays strike the test mass, charge it up, and then the same voltages that you're using to sense it are actually pushing it around electrostatically. And so you, every 30 minutes or so, you have to shine a UV light on the test mass to decharge it to prevent the electrostatic forces from building up. And so to demonstrate, you would like, before spending the money on this, to demonstrate that this really works and has that noise performance. And the only way to do it is to get it far away from the Earth in a geostationary orbiter above. And so one of the proposals of the technology plan, LISA, is part of the money you actually spend doing that, to send up a little test satellite to demonstrate that you actually can produce these sensors. The other thing you have to have is you have to have little thrusters on the spacecraft, which are very linear, and if you sense the test mass moving, you can push the spacecraft around to follow it. And you want to have sort of micro-Newton thrusts, not measured in pounds force, we hope, but in micro-Newton. and you want them to be linear and low noise so that you can actually control the spacecraft reproducibly. 2 years ago, in LISA's last technology reviews, these were considered very dicey. They're now manufactured commercially by Hughes Aircraft for use in space station keeping for geosynchronous satellites, and they've actually flown and they work. The thrusts that they apply are somewhat larger than this, but it's now no longer regarded as a technology issue because they're almost off the shelf now. But again, we require somewhat more stringent requirements than the ones that are actually commercial. Okay. Just a brief summary of polarization of gravitational waves. As I mentioned, they come in two polarizations, and if I have a source on the sky, for example, one that's like this or like this, they produce different polarizations. The source, which is edge-on like this, will produce the plus polarization, squeezing and contracting in these directions. The source at 45 degrees will squeeze and contract like this. And if the source is undergoing a circular orbit on the sky like this, you'll have plus plus I cross, they'll be 90 degrees out of phase, and you have the cosine with one polarization and the sine of the other polarization. So if you can measure the two polarizations, you actually get the orientation of the orbit on the sky, not only the inclination, which astronomers are familiar with, but actually if you could see the orbit, which angle it would be on the sky, modulo 90 degrees, uncertainty here. So, as I mentioned, there are 3,000 white dwarf binaries which LISA can see. Some of those you could actually use an interferometer, like the Keck interferometer, to look at the orbit on the sky and then see if the polarization was what LISA said it was. That's sort of a test of relativity of some kind. Just to point out that with this equilateral triangle, you do measure both polarizations. So you can think, if you take L1 minus L2, you can break down the polarization into an XY piece and a piece at 45 degrees. The XY piece cancels if you take L1 minus L2 and you're just measuring the components at 45 degrees. And so you can measure H plus from L1 minus L2. And if you take L1 minus L3 plus L2 minus L3, you can see that those give you H cross. So linear combinations of these three arms will give you the two polarizations independently. Just point out that LIGO actually only measures one polarization, and the reason is that you want the two detectors, one in Washington and one in Louisiana, to be able to, you have to do noise rejection, so you want them to be seeing the same signal, because in principle these two polarizations from the source can be completely uncorrelated. So if you see an event which is uncorrelated with your other detector, it could be noise or it could be a real signal. So LIGO by design has the two interferometers lined up, so they're actually seeing the same polarization. Now, of course, LIGO might eventually operate in conjunction with Virgo and Thomas 300 and many other detectors, which are, so one might eventually get the other polarizations by correlating with the other detectors. So just to summarize, the LISA data would then consist of a data stream consisting of H plus of T and H cross of T, sampled, let's say, at once every 10 seconds for 3 years. So if we sort of look at the peak of the minimum and the sensitivity curve around 3×10⁻³ hertz over 3 years, you get 300,000 wave cycles in each of those polarizations. LISA is an all-sky instrument. It's like a dipole antenna. It has a weak antenna pattern, but it monitors the whole sky. So every source in the sky you detect all the time, and they're all mixed up in this signal. So I like to think of it as LISA is basically a it's like your ears when you go to a symphony concert. There are 70 instruments playing at you, and how do you distinguish them? You do it in frequency space, Fourier transform, and different sources have different frequencies. You can tell the trumpets from the bass vials by the frequencies. But you also have your ears, which are, will give you a little stereoscopic sense, so you can tell which side of the orchestra the things are coming from. So LISA can do that too, can determine directions, the sources. And the way it determines the directions is in two pieces. One is LISA is orbiting the sun at 30 kilometers a second. So as LISA goes around the source in any direction other than the ecliptic pole will be, its frequency will be modulated by a fraction of 30 kilometers a second divided by C, or by a fractional amount of 10⁻⁴. And the amount of that modulation depends on the ecliptic latitude, zero at the pole and maximum in the ecliptic plane, and the phase tells you where it is in ecliptic longitude. So you can determine a two-dimensional direction. And the technique is exactly how pulsar astronomers determine the directions to pulsars, just using Doppler shifting of the Earth's orbit. But there's another effect which works at low frequencies, which is that the plane of the detector, of the three detectors, is rotating. So if you have the source in some direction with a particular polarization, for example, if the detector is face-on to it, it would see zero amplitude, whereas when it's edge-on, it will see maximal amplitude. So there's an amplitude modulation. So the two terms in there which one can use, there's basically an FM and an AM term, frequency and amplitude modulation. And the FM term, the orbital frequency modulation, takes the gravitational wave signal and spreads it by an amount, 1 plus V plus minus V over C. But of course, it's actually a series of sidebands, which are a frequency of 1 over a year, angular frequency 2 pi over a year, and radio amateur ham operators know about these Bessel functions. The number of sidebands is then basically the gravitational wave frequency divided by C over the velocity of the Earth times the orbital frequency of the Earth. That's this characteristic number, 3×10⁻⁴ hertz. And you can see that there will be many sidebands for frequencies above 10⁻³ hertz, so you'll get lots of information on the position of the source. But at lower frequencies, there's just the main signal and very weak sidebands, so this technique gets less good at low frequencies. Simulations that have been done for exactly how well in a confused situation of various types of sources you can determine the position is about a degree for a weak source at 10⁻²⁰ hertz, a degree for a strong source at 10⁻³ hertz, or about 10 degrees for a weak source at 10⁻³ hertz. At low frequencies, the AM modulation, the fact that the given polarization will be modulated as the interferometer orientation changes over the orbit, that will produce three bands with separation of twice the Earth's orbital frequency. Factor of two is because gravity waves are quadrupole, right? So if they rotate 90 degrees, it's the same. That dominates the position determination below 10⁻³ hertz. And at low frequencies, you basically get a degree resolution for strong sources and 10 degrees for weak sources. So what are the sources? Well, as I mentioned in my little diagram of everything in the universe, there are basically two classes of objects. There are things with orbital periods between 2 hours and 20 seconds, and those, the ones with amplitudes that we could see, are binary stars in our galaxy, white dwarfs, neutron stars, or black holes, with gravitational wave lifetimes between 10⁻⁹ years and 50 years or so. And the amplitudes on scales of the galaxy are like 10 to the minus 20 to 10 to the minus 22. These sources will be periodic, so you should compare that to the Lisa sensitivity over 1 year of 3 by 10 to the minus 25. Okay, so these will be detected with large signal to noise. The other class of source that can be detected are objects near the last stable orbit of a supermassive black hole, one sensitive to black hole masses of 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 5 solar masses. That corresponds to these frequencies being in the Lisa band, divided by 1 plus the redshift, and as I'll show you, the signals and noises are such that this redshift, if the objects exist, could be quite large, like 100. The gravity wave lifetimes of these types of objects could be 1 to 10 years, and the amplitudes are like 10 to the minus 22 times the mass of the thing falling in solar masses. So you see, in addition to seeing, if I were dropping a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole into another one, I have a signal of 10 to the minus 16, and I can hardly miss it no matter what goes wrong with the spacecraft. But even a one solar mass thing, just a little star falling into a supermassive black hole, is detectable at cosmological distances. So here is a map of what the LISA sky map might actually look like. There are about 3,000 little white dwarf binaries in the galaxy. And the angular resolution, the bright dots are the strong sources where you'd have degree resolution, and the big fuzzy ones you can't see so well are the weak sources with the 10-degree resolution. So you get the positions, and if we're right and they're white dwarfs, they should be concentrated in the galactic plane, as shown there. And then there will be all kinds of things popping off, and stars falling into black holes and binary black holes merging. And optimistically, I won't say very much about this, but the Lisa frequency band is just about right if the electroweak phase transition actually was sufficiently first order, which I gather is no longer popular. So perhaps we shouldn't consider it anymore, but maybe it will come back into vogue, or maybe some other phase transition that would be sort of horizon scales at some basically any phase transition that is produces bubbles with velocities greater than 10 to the minus 2c and happens around 100 MeV to 10 GeV or something would end up in the LISA window. We've also been thinking about follow-ons to LISA, and if you make LISA's telescope mirrors as big as NGST's mirrors, you can improve the sensitivity by a factor of 1,000 or so, and then you actually could really above 0.1 hertz when the din of all the... With that sensitivity, you could see every binary star in the universe ever created. So it's quite it's a din to get around. So you work at high frequencies where the din is only intermittent, and probably there you actually might be able to get down to see the the fluctuations from inflation, the gravity wave predictions from inflation. Yeah, it'll be the worst cafe you've ever been in, probably, yeah. Okay, so a little bit more detail about the sources LISA can see. As I mentioned, there will be 3,000 distinguishable white dwarf binaries, and I claim that 3,000 is probably accurate to a factor of 2. That may amaze some of you who are familiar with astrophysics, but the reason I'm confident of that number is that I can vary lots of other numbers by a factor of 100, and that one doesn't change. So the reason that I'm confident about this is that if you think how binary white dwarf pairs are created, they're created, if I have a giant star orbited, like originally have two stars like the sun, let's say, and one of them makes a white dwarf, and then that white dwarf is left orbiting the other one. The other star swells up and becomes a giant, but it's now more massive, so when it begins to transfer mass to the other one, there's a dynamical instability, and this white dwarf spirals into the middle of the other one. If the initial separation is wide, the orbital energy released is more than enough to unbind the envelope, and I have to shrink the orbit enough to release that energy to unbind the envelope, and I'm left with two white dwarfs, the nucleus of the red giant and the original white dwarf, orbiting each other in a short period. We know lots of systems like this in the galaxy. We even know some that will merge in less than 10 to the 9 years. You see them in the centers of half of all planetary nebulae. In other words, you can see this remnant ejected envelope and the two little white dwarfs orbiting each other in the center. No problem. However, the actual separation depends on the efficiency of envelope injection. And if you see a parameter alpha in astrophysics, you know that it's uncertain by a factor of 10 at least. But I claim that this efficiency is unlikely to be larger than 100%. Actually, it could be 500%, but that's another story. But it's unlikely to be larger than 500%. Don't forget ionization recombination energy. So if I make stars like this, and I even allow the efficiency to be 1 or a bit larger than 1, I create binaries that will merge in much less than the age of the universe. If the efficiency is lower than that, which it could well be, then I have to make the binary even smaller to emit enough energy to unbind the envelope. So even with the best efficiency, I make something that can merge in the age of the universe. If the efficiency is less than that, it will just merge faster. So I'll always get these binaries close enough to produce interesting gravity wave signals since they were created in the past Hubble time. Now, the birth rate in those binaries is somewhat uncertain. It might be, everybody thinks it's probably 1 every 20 years within a factor of 2, but the worst limits you could possibly put on it are between 1 every 5 years, which is how many stars are formed in the galaxy. If every star that forms does this, that's an upper limit to the rate. Or 3 by 10 to the minus 3 per year, and that's the rate you get from the observed systems that have been discovered by sort of accidental, desperate searches by optical astronomers looking for these things. So that's a factor of 1,000 in the rate, a factor of 100 in the rate. But the reason I'm confident of this 3,000 is that what limits me in the number of objects that LISA can see is the confusion. Basically, there will be so many of these binaries at low frequencies where the lifetimes are very long, and therefore the number of binaries which are ejected at some period, like 10 to the minus 4 hertz, and then evolve under gravitational radiation, and they evolve more and more rapidly as they get closer together, and the number of objects then has this given characteristic minus 8/3 spectrum, which comes just from saying that d by d nu of the number at a given frequency times the frequency derivative given by gravitational radiation shrinking the orbit is 0, or some small number of sources out here. I can integrate that spectrum, and there are so many objects out here that LISA won't be able to individually distinguish them. It will easily detect their signal, but there will be so many that in the frequency resolution of LISA, there will be hundreds of binaries in that frequency band. So if I reduce the rate of formation of binaries, I basically reduce the confusion, and I can see down to a lower frequency before I get confused. If the rate is very high, there are lots of them, and I can only see down to a high frequency before I get confused. But either way, I get 3,000 binaries before I get confused. Okay, so the Fourier transform of 2 weeks of LISA data would look something like this. And these high peaks are nearby sources, sort of 10 or 300 parsecs away, and the lower peaks are more distant sources, or some of the higher ones are massive double neutron star systems instead of small white dwarfs. And you can see where things go black down here is where I can see the individual sources because there are little holes between the delta functions of each source. And up here, I'm starting getting into confusion. There are many sources in each frequency band, so there are no holes between the sources. And this is the 5 sigma threshold for LISA. And this is only 2 weeks of data. Okay. I'll say one particularly interesting thing that LISA will do is it will produce a census. One can measure actually a number of parameters of these binaries. I should say that actually. So for each binary, you measure the position within a degree or a little bit worse. You measure the frequency of the binary. And for the shorter period, few hundred sources, you'll also be able to see over a 3-year lifetime the change in the orbital frequency. So you'll be able to determine the time scale on which they will merge. And you'll measure from the amplitudes of the signals, you'll measure the chirp mass, and therefore the distance to the binary in centimeters. So you'll get a 3-dimensional map of the galaxy. You'll know which ones are at the galactic center, which ones on the far side, which ones on the near side. And 10% distance may not seem great to a physicist or an engineer, but in astronomy, that's very few sources that we actually know the distance to 10%. So it's quite remarkable. And this map is not affected by dust extinction in the galaxy. The gravity waves do not have a problem getting through dust. Now, the fact that for the shorter period sources, you measure nu and nu dot, means that you'll be able to predict the date at which the final merger will happen for these sources. So, in particular, you'll be able to predict two things, and one of them will might have a chance in my lifetime, the other one probably not. The nearest in the galaxy, if the formation rate of double white dwarfs is 1 every 20 years, one of those sources will be one which will merge in the next 20 years. So you'll be able to predict that on 2027, in July, in this direction, 2.4 solar mass stars will hit each other, and that might be an interesting thing for optical and X-ray astronomers to look at. Now, more excitingly, on a timescale possibly 1 every 300 years, two white dwarfs whose total mass is greater than 1.4 solar mass in our galaxy will hit each other and do the same thing. And those, of course, have two choices. Either that makes a neutron star, accretion-induced collapse, or the whole thing blows up. And the whole thing blowing up is one popular model of type 1a supernovae. So you could predict the date of the next type 1a supernova in the galaxy and the position and know the masses of the objects beforehand, etc. In this case, actually, with that, and you also measure the period, the frequency second derivative, so you can actually see tidal effects in the white dwarfs. The white dwarfs will be close enough for this merging system that you actually can see both the tides plus the GR. It could be a type 1a supernovae, or if it isn't, it's an accretion-induced collapse, and that will be a fantastic gravity wave source, possibly, if it makes a bar on its way in or something. Either case, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Unfortunately, the rate in our galaxy is once every few hundred years, so it's not, unless we're lucky, it's not, we will predict it, but we won't be around to see it. Okay.
Do you know what biologists can do?
Yeah, perhaps at least clones of ourselves might be able to. Okay, enough for the galaxy. How about supermassive black holes? And so this is, I think, is sort of a summary of what we would know about supermassive black holes in the universe and the LISA predictions, and probably everything on this page is within a factor of a few of the best possible estimates we can make of the event rates for these. So the argument goes as following. We can see about 2 billion galaxies like the Milky Way in the known universe, and if we go down to dwarf galaxies, they're about 10 to the 10. So anything that one of these galaxies does in its lifetime will correspond to an event that LISA can see at a rate of about 1 per year. Right? Because we can see these events out the redshifts of 30, so anything that happens, we'll be able to see it. And if they're 10 to the 10 galaxies, and if once in their life they do something interesting, that will be one event per year for LISA to look at. So you can do very sophisticated integrations over star formation rates and black hole formation rates. Okay, so what interesting things might happen to black holes in the middles of galaxies? Well, galaxies merge. If the black holes in the centers then subsequently merge, you can merge big black holes together. Signal to noise of 10 to the 4. The black holes form. They form by putting lots of little pieces together or collapsing a big star. They were there primordially and they accreted. Some of those scenarios produce lots of gravity waves, others don't, but we could look for the formation. And stars can fall into the black hole. You remember I said you could see a one solar mass object falling into a supermassive black hole at interesting distances. And so at least it could see those. It can see a white dwarf spiraling into a supermassive black hole at a redshift 0.2, or a stellar mass black hole at a redshift of 1. Now, how do we know these black holes exist? Well, there's one of 2.6 by 10 to the 6 solar masses in the center of our galaxy. There are lots of stars around it. There are 2 by 10 to the 6 stars in the central light year. And those stars, here's the positions of some of those stars relative to the unusual radio source at the center of our galaxy in 1995, 6, 7, 8. And with Keck adaptive optics, there's now a 1999 point, which I don't have, which is 10 times smaller than these points. And you can actually see the tracks are all curving around the black hole now. It's no longer just straight lines. You can see them curving, and they're all curving in the right way. They really are orbiting that center there. And these velocities are a few thousand kilometers a second. This one is 1,400 kilometers a second. the velocity of dispersion farther out is like 100 kilometers a second. It's going up like 1 over square root of r. There's no question about it. And you can see here's the mass as a function of radius. It's constant inside a few tenths of a parsec. And at 1 parsec, there's a stellar cluster. So there's this very dense stellar cluster around the black hole. Our galaxy is not unusual. The next galaxy to us, M31, and its little companion, M32, both have respectively 2 by 10 to the 7 and 3 by 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes in their nuclei, and they're the masses of other black holes we know in nearby galaxies. And essentially, every respectable galaxy with a bulge in its center has a big black hole in the middle. I'm sorry? Because you can measure their dynamical effect in the center of the galaxy. I'm not saying there's a theoretical reason they're there. I mean, if we knew how they formed, I could answer in some theoretical way. But observationally, there are dark things in the centers of galaxies which make all the stars in the middle of them orbit fast. So, and they produce quasars and Seyfert galaxies, et cetera. Now, I should say, we don't know that they're black holes described by general relativity. So that's one of the things that LISA could do, is tell you whether these, in fact, I mean, they could be exotic soliton stars that are held up at 1.5 Schwarzschild radii by mysterious forces we haven't thought of. And that, because we're measuring all the dynamics fairly far out and rather imprecisely, we can't say, but most people think they're described by relativity. So here's the signal-to-noise 5 LISA sensitivity curve in 1 year. And just to illustrate here, are merging 10 to the 7 black holes starting 1 year, 3 days in coalescence for Schwarzschild or maximal Kerr. Here's the same thing for 10 to the 6 solar masses, 1 year, 3 days, 1 day. Here's 10 to the 5 solar masses, and on this one I've also drawn redshift 10, 100, and 1,000. So if they're anywhere, we can see it. Gravitational waveform, well, that depends a little bit on numerical relativity. We can get the beginning parts when it's post-Newtonian. We can get the ring down when it's small perturbations to a black hole. In the middle, will depend on big computers and clever numerical relativity. But LISA will measure this curve very accurately. This will not be signal-to-noise 10, but signal-to-noise 10 to the 4. So whatever that curve is, you'll get very good measurements of it. Stellar cusps in the centers of galaxies. We see lots of stars in the centers of galaxies. All the black holes seem to have dense clusters around them. And stars will be scattered. A star initially on a circular orbit will pass by some other star and be deflected onto an orbit that plunges close to the black hole, a very almost radial orbit. And if that orbit gets close enough to the black hole, and if it doesn't get perturbed while it's doing that nearly radial orbit for a while, gravitational radiation can shrink the epicenter enough that the star is then unlikely to encounter a subsequent star because its lifetime is so short. And the star would then be trapped onto a highly elliptical orbit, which would be dominated by gravitational radiation reaction, gradually shrinking the epicenter, the paracenter initially remaining almost fixed. And you can show that that only happens if this paracenter is within a few gravitational radii. So initially, these orbits would have orbital periods of years and be way out of the LISA frequency band. But as they shrink, eventually the epicenter will get short enough that the whole thing will be in the LISA frequency band. So we'd see the orbit shrinking. If Kepler's laws were appropriate, the orbit would just never precess. If it were a Schwarzschild black hole, of course, the orbit precesses in a plane. And if it's a Kerr black hole, not only does the orbit precess in a plane, but the plane precesses around because the potential is no longer spherically symmetric. So we would be able to see through the, since we can measure both H plus and H cross, the two polarizations, as the orbital plane is precessed, you'll see the amplitudes in these two polarizations varying in a characteristic way. This has been computed recently by Scott Hughes. Here's an example of the star in a circular orbit, which is not realistic, but is much easier to calculate. In fact, we don't really know how to do the elliptical case, although many postdocs at Caltech and other places are working very hard to figure out how to do radiation reaction correctly in relativity perturbation theory. But here's the case of a circular orbit, A over M, 0.95 black hole at 62 degrees to the orbit of a 5 solar mass black hole at 7 gravitational radii. And you can see there's vast richness in the polarization structures, and that's because the orbit is the rosette, and the plane of the rosette is precessing, and that's producing all of that modulation you see there. Now, because of that modulation, you can measure many parameters. It's all in the strong field, a few gravitational radii. You can measure many parameters of the metric. And if relativity is correct, the only parameters that matter should end up being the mass and the angular momentum of the black hole. If you're a particle physicist, you probably think charge might matter, but astrophysically it gets shorted out, so we forget about charge. So the No-Hare theorem says that any orbit should be described just by the mass and angular momentum of the orbit. By studying these waveforms, and remember, this is 20 hours of data, you'd have 3 years of data, a lot of richness, you see it finally crossing the horizon, you get the whole metric mapped out from, say, 7 to a few gravitational radii, wherever the horizon is, you get the whole three-dimensional metric mapped out. You can measure many of those parameters, and you can see whether they are all precisely described by the predictions of relativity. I'll just remind you that the Kerr metric is actually amazingly special in the family of all possible kinds of things that might be compact objects, that the Kerr metric has a fourth integral, this miraculous Carter constant. And that means there's no chaos in the orbits. There is an analytical fourth integral you can write down, so the orbits are not chaotic. Any perturbation you make to the Kerr metric introduces chaotic orbits. So seeing these orbits of the stars around the black hole is actually quite interesting because it's very sensitive to this miraculous feature. Of course, small perturbations only introduce small regions of chaos, so perhaps you need a few stars to explore it, but in principle it's quite a powerful test, in addition to just the classic one of measuring the moments of the metric and verifying they satisfy the No-Hare theorem. Okay, what about the, I'll just conclude with the rate. How often should this happen? Well, we know that the rate of ordinary stars being captured by supermassive black holes is about 1 every 10 to the 4 years per galaxy. And there are about 5 candidate events of this now, which have been detected with the ultraviolet and the X-ray satellites. Here's one of them. We don't know in any individual cases if that's right, but the rate at which these flares are being seen is at least consistent with the theoretical estimates of 1 every 10 to the 4 years per galaxy. And in the volume that LISA could see these, with signal to noise greater than 50, there are about 2 million galaxies, so that's 200 of these tidal disruptions of ordinary stars per year. Now, the ordinary stars are no good because they get tidally disrupted at very many gravitational radii, and so they don't produce this nice signal. So you're interested in white dwarf neutron stars and black holes. So you should multiply that 200 per year times whatever fraction of the stars you think are in the center are white dwarf neutron stars and black holes. If there were no mass segregation or anything else, that would be 10 or 20%, so it's lots of events per year. However, things are more complicated, and there are many papers discussing whether the rate is 0.5 per year or 3 per year, et cetera, but I won't go into that. Okay, you've all been waiting for the bottom line. Now get out your wallets. And I will pass this around. We don't actually have enough funding to buy a proper hat, but I have a paper hat here. Cost is $450 million, $1999. That includes a 30% contingency. In other words, we estimate the cost is $300 million. That's the cost of building the spacecraft, launching it, operating it for 5 years. And it's including the technology development, namely this additional satellite to be launched to test the detector.
So what should I compare this to? The metric conversion disaster was 150.
That's right. The Hubble Space Telescope is about 6 or 8 billion, depending on how you do the accounting. The Chandra X-ray satellite that was just launched is about 2 billion.
So this
is a half ESA, half NASA mission. So the cost to NASA is $225 million. And NASA launches something like that every 6 months. Okay, so this is not the cheapest NASA missions, are about $70 million or something. Yeah? Well, as you see, we're passing the hat, which means the technology development money is... if you put something in there, we can give you a more detailed answer. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. As I say, the technology by LIGO standards is completely trivial. On the other hand, there are serious issues that nobody has ever flown an inertial test mass system with noise performance like this because it's never been put in an environment where you could measure and demonstrate that it had that performance. And so it's a little bit hard to give an answer. Obviously, you'd like to do some technology development and then find out really how good things are. My sense is it's been through several technology reviews. The latest one was quite favorable. This seems to be doing well both in the NASA strategic planning and in the decadal survey reviews in both physics and astronomy. You know, all NASA missions have technology worries. This is basically in the same category as proposals to build giant interferometers to look for Earth-like planets around distant stars. It is behind the technology, the Next Generation Space Telescope, which is deployable graphite mirrors 8 meters across, cryogenically cooled at L2. X-ray interferometers in space. And, you know, you might, in deciding how realistic the technology is, there's sort of shades of technology. And, you know, I'm not a laser physicist, so I can't really discuss the quality of the laser frequency stabilization schemes that are in the detailed plans. If you would like them, there are many thick books. I didn't bring the thickest of them, which is the technology roadmap, but here's the LISA pre-phase A book that describes all the details of the lasers. I have a few more popular looking brochures here as, if some of you are interested. Oh, well, it's just that, I mean, there are no expendables. Basically, what happens is that the satellite is gradually drifting behind the Earth. So as it gets farther and farther away from the Earth, you get fewer and fewer bits per second if you put in the current, I think we have a $6 million antenna or something on the thing. So in principle, there are no real expenditures. The ion microthrusters, a few grams of fuel will last for 20 years or something, so there's no sort of weight issues on those. So in principle, it could operate for 10 years if nothing breaks. But the design mission is 3 years, but it takes a year to drift out. The data taking is for 3 years in the nominal mission, but it takes a year to drift out sufficiently far behind the Earth that you start operating, so there's 4 years of operations put in there. And that's the nominal mission, but like all, I think the Hubble Space Telescope nominally was 3 years too or something, but you hope if it keeps working with some funding line. And the operations, remember, this is a few numbers every 10 seconds. This is not an enormous data stream. We do not have, LIGO is collecting megabytes per second, right? And so there's big data handling and data analysis and correlation. Here you're getting, you know, a few hundred bits per second or something. And so it's not huge teams and huge computers needed to operate. You know, you can do it on your PC at home or something. You can do the Fourier transforms for the whole 3 years of data. So the operations are just a few million dollars a year. So it's not a big component.
Couldn't combine some of these interferometers.
I'm sorry?
You couldn't use the same spacing mount other things.
No, you don't want to mount anything else on this because the whole point is to have nothing which is generating heat, vibrations, excess particles anywhere near these. You want them really quiet, yeah. No, this is not something you want to mount on the space station, for example. Or
so is space debris a problem?
Well, fortunately, although we've screwed up low Earth orbit pretty well.
This is
not Earth orbit. This is
right.
Sun orbit.
Right.
So,
right.
So
this is the first jump.
It's not the first junk, but the CERTA, for example, the Space Infrared Telescope, will be in the same kind of orbit as this. So we hope it won't run into CERTA, but there's a lot of space out there. One thing which people have worried about is the problem of asteroids, sort of small asteroids passing by and producing a spurious gravitational signal. But basically what happens is that the asteroids which are numerous enough to worry about only produce a significant signal if they get very close to one spacecraft. So it's a signal in one spacecraft and not the other two, and so it's easy to remove, and the event rate isn't very high, so the thing doesn't look as if it's a problem. Okay, so the status, we don't actually know yet, but the rumors I hear, and I have to go do a few more performances, but it seems hopeful that it might actually, any of you are in the audience, get into the NASA strategic plan and the recommendations of the Astronomy and Astrophysics Decadal Survey Review. LISA actually has been for about 6 years an approved cornerstone mission, $600 million European accounting units, or $600 million, for launch in 2017. Unfortunately, ESA has recently discovered it has budget problems, and so it's cutting all the cornerstone missions and trying to find cheaper ones. And so $225 million looks a lot better than $600 million, so we're hopeful that the downsizing of ESA will actually be a good thing for LISA rather than a bad thing, but that's politics. So let me just end by saying that Holtz and Taylor got the Nobel Prize for the discovery of Pulsar 1913+16, whose orbit is decaying. It's a little bit below LISA's frequency band, but there ought to be lots of other things like it in the sky. Let's go see the gravity waves.
Questions and comments? Questions? Gary?
Yeah. Do you need to know the sort of distance between your spacecraft very accurately for this? I mean, your dimensions sort of set changes in the light of 10 to minus 12 meters or something. But the actual distance is sort of fluctuating.
Yeah, the distance actually does fluctuate, because remember the spacecraft are in orbits around the center of the sun, and there are all kinds of perturbations from Jupiter and everything else. And so the separation between the three arms actually changes at about 15 meters per second. So there's a Doppler shift. That's actually a very good thing, because it separates the incoming signal of one spacecraft from the outgoing signal of the own spacecraft, because otherwise you might worry about scattered light confusing which signal is which. So the Doppler shift is actually a very good thing, and it's actually part of the design. The disadvantage is that if that velocity were much higher than 10 meters a second, you have to have a very wide bandwidth. You have to be able to coherently combine signals across a very large bandwidth, much bigger than 100 megahertz, and so that gets bad. So a design configuration of the choice of the orbits actually is that you couldn't make the arm separation much bigger than 5 million kilometers, or the relative Doppler shifts become much bigger than this 10 meters per second. And we don't think, or at least I'm not, those who understand lasers don't think they can stabilize the cavity with present technology across such wide bandwidths. So that's actually one of the design parameters. You don't actually have, basically with ordinary spacecraft tracking at radio frequencies, you always know the position of the spacecraft within about 10 meters, just from traditional spacecraft tracking, unless, as long as you keep the pounds and nautical miles and so on straight. One of the sort of tricky bits in the beginning of LISA is that you have to be able, one spacecraft has to lock on to the other, that's 5 million kilometers apart, and you have to be able to orient it so that the laser is actually oriented, and you have to keep it locked, because you don't want, although the beam is 20 kilometers across, the beam is probably not a perfect plane, and so you don't want little phase shifts as you move up and down the beam, which would appear as gravity wave signals, so you want to keep it quite accurately locked. So one of the first things you have to do is, this initial spacecraft tracking isn't good enough to know where to point one of the spacecraft to find the other one, so you have to do a little raster scan, actually across 100 elements, till you find it. But the one spacecraft sees the other one as sort of like a fifth magnitude star or something. It's quite bright, so once you find it, there's no problem keeping it there. But initially you don't have to know the separation very precisely. You just measure the changes once you've acquired it.
Questions?
Well, I'm not officially involved in the LIGO project, so I can't give you an official answer, but it's having its official opening, I think, on November 12th or 17th or something, was the invitation I got. And it will sort of, I understand, start operations next year. The question of whether the initial design will actually see things, there are no sources, I would say, of which one can be confident that the initial design is sensitive enough to see. And so at some point in the improvements of the lasers and the test masks and the suspension system, there the hope is. But on the other hand, the history of opening up new windows in astrophysics is that the theorists have not thought of everything, and the optical astronomers have not already discovered everything. So might see something when it turns on, too. Let's see.
Questions? Well, let's thank the speaker again.